Hanna Albayati is an Iraqi-French documentary filmmaker and journalist for the Egyptian-based Al Aram Weekly. Based in Brussels, she is a member of the executive committee of the Brussels Tribunal, which is composed of intellectuals, artists, and activists who have denounced the logic of permanent war promoted by the American government and its allies, concentrating for the time being on one region of the world, the Middle East. I happen to be a member of the Tribunal's advisory committee. After reading an intriguing article in Al Aram about the plight of Arab intellectuals and their relationship to the Arab Spring that she co-authored a week ago with Abdul Ilah Albayati and Ian Douglas, I decided to pursue the subject further and connect it to similar problems that afflict many Western intellectuals, particularly with regards to the most recent events in the region, the death of Gaddafi and the announced withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. And so I contacted Hanna Albayati, and I'm speaking today with her in Cairo. Welcome, Hanna Albayati, to Takes on the World.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being there. And now you're in Cairo. We're going to talk a little bit about Egypt. But there is so much to talk about, but I'd like to begin with the subject of that article, your article, that has received scant amount of coverage, and that is the response of Arab intellectuals to the uprising in the Arab world, and by extension, the response of Western intellectuals in Europe and the United States as well. According to your article, the Arab intelligentsia was as unprepared for what began in Tunis as were the leaders of the Arab governments themselves.
Yeah, well, actually, it's part of a series of articles, which one is titled Libya, How to Abort the Libyan Democracy or Uprising for Democracy. I think it's more or less part of the crisis of the left worldwide, that they don't actually see facts on the ground or any are incapable of any objective analysis. So whether it's the people who are arguing for humanitarian or against humanitarian intervention or Arab intellectuals that actually share a lot of their problems in the analysis of what's going on. And what we argue is that not only there is a democratic uprising from the youth mainly, but that is supported by many other parts of society, but this is inevitable, and that to stand against the revolution is to stand against progress. Unfortunately, whether it's Arab intellectuals or Western intellectuals who are influenced by leftist ideology, they think that to be part of the left is part of a rhetorical kind of annunciation of being a leftist, and they don't study the situation on the ground. So they stood by Gaddafi in the name that he makes speeches against imperialist policies. But as a matter of fact, since 2003, Gaddafi has changed his policies, whether it's economically, politically. He has been one of the best allies of the West. So we criticize this kind of position.
Well, I know I was happened to be one of the few people, let's say, on the left who took a critical position on Gaddafi, whose career I've been following for a number of years. And those friends of mine, many who write on the blogs, major blogs in the United States and elsewhere, were as selective in looking at Gaddafi's past as the propagandists are for the U.S. government in attacking Gaddafi. This whole mention that you mentioned of the collaboration with the United States for the last 10 years, plus the brutality, the crackdown, and the mass murder of prisoners in the jail in Tripoli in 1996, totally ignored. And as you write in the article, they have the inability to both be against foreign intervention and against dictatorship. And this was, when I saw this line in the article, I rejoiced because I've been having this argument fruitlessly, and I've given it up with a number of people who insist that Gaddafi was the greatest hero, and that he was a hero throughout Africa, and that they cite these statistics of the wealth, the welfare of the Libyan people being better than any people in Africa. Of course, obviously the Libyan people didn't see it that way.
No, of course the Libyan people didn't see it that way, and it's part of this black and white manner of thinking. It's very actually troubling because it's very similar to Islamist thinking of sacredness inside political concepts, and saying either it's black or white. So either you are with Gaddafi or you are with the foreign intervention. It deprives the capacity to think, actually. And I think people who don't like label themselves as intellectuals are much more related to the ground and to the realities of the ground. And the Libyan youth, like every other Arab youth people everywhere in this part of the world, are trying to defeat a model of non-development, which is globalization via clientelist governments who rule through a police state, and it's not working, and it's crumbling, and it's widespread. It has nothing to do with a particular situation in one country. It's shared by every country of this region because it has led to disillusionment, unemployment, extreme poverty, illiteracy, and like everything that is against the interest of the people. So the youth believes that it has the right to have a voice in the future of their country, and they are uprising everywhere. You will find the same intellectuals who support Gaddafi supporting the Assad Syrian government, which is as brutal as Gaddafi has been for the last few months. And they again argue that he is a champion in anti-imperialism. And they also support Ahmadinejad. They do support an Islamist state that is cracking down on any kind of dissent in the name that Ahmadinejad makes some kind of rhetorical speeches against imperialism. But then if you look at the situation, he's the best ally of the U.S. occupation in destroying Iraq.
Well, it's interesting. I go back a number of years, and so what is depressing for me is I've seen the same response to, let's say, the situation with supporting of Ahmadinejad or Assad or Gaddafi as I saw during the Cold War when police states in Eastern Europe were supported by the left simply because they were opposed by U.S. imperialism, and that seems to be like a knee-jerk reaction. If they're opposed by U.S. imperialism, the left is obligated to defend these people as if there's good guys versus bad guys. And this is something that's depressing to see the same people, actually, some of them my age, repeating the same mistakes they made during the Cold War.
Yeah, it's this very sad dichotomy, as if we were not capable of further imagination and further analysis capacity. And you see, and I actually read them a lot, and they also stand by this myth that China is communist or that Russia is still Sovietic, when in fact the competition among the different big powers in the world regarding what is going on in the Middle East is very, very pragmatic in terms of their state interests. And it has nothing to do with ideology. Russia will boycott a resolution in the Security Council about Syria for mere weapons, armaments, deals. It has nothing to do with being influenced by the left or not. Or China, the same.
This again is true. There's a tendency, if you're not a player on the ground and you're living vicariously through the internet or through your intellectual life, but are not really participating, you tend to want to see something that isn't there. And China, of course, the fact that the Communist Party runs China, it's so remote from the nature of true communism that they're the experts on capitalism these days.
Exactly. Yeah.
My guest is Hannah Albayati. We're talking to her in Cairo. One of the things that troubled me about what happened in Libya is that by Gaddafi's initial threats to go house to house and wipe out people, it was like an invitation for intervention by the West. But what it did when that happened was to take attention away from what was happening in Egypt and Bahrain and Yemen and so on, and focus everything on Libya. And that has allowed, for example, in Egypt, the military to assume the powers of Mubarak. And you're in Cairo today. What do you see happening there?
Well, I'm in Cairo since 6 years, actually. Well, it's very complex. I understand the worries of the Egyptian population regarding the transitional period and the pace of the transitional period. But if you actually see the realities that there is a tremendous labor movement in every sections of the economy, there is a very, very strong union movement, an independent and free union movement, breaking away from the state-controlled unions that were here since, like, the 52 revolution. There is, of course, a lot of competitions among different forces that now are suddenly capable of being outspoken about their opinions. And there is a very, very deep and saddening and depressing, actually, division among the leftists who are bickering against each other and unable to form a coalition to represent a real force in the upcoming elections. Then, you know, a lot is being said about the military wanting to retain power. I actually don't fall into this. I believe that the military is trying to please every existing forces in the country and cannot please the left when the left is making so many strategic mistakes.
And not for the first time, I should say. One thing about Egypt particularly, but also the whole Arab Spring, is there is another thing that has troubled me, and I found you called attention to that in your article, is the tendency on the part of a lot of Western intellectuals who do not give credit to the peoples of North Africa and the Middle East to rise up against their dictators, and they believe that all this is a plot by the United States through non-governmental organizations, that they had some meetings in Washington. And they had some meetings in Serbia with some people who were involved in getting rid of Milosevic. And suddenly, this is what caused the uprising in Egypt. And the idea that Egyptians could be manipulated so easily, when the United States, of course, is a total failure in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, elsewhere, is kind of a joke. But your comments on that, on the Westerners who think this is all a U.S. plot.
Well, I think it's rooted in the basic colonialism and racism of the West, that they cannot actually trust that the Arabs would be capable of being democratic. Therefore, it has to come from an outside power. And they spread this kind of propaganda. A lot of our friends, like you mentioned, are spreading this propaganda about Libya, about Syria, initially about Egypt, but then, like, the Egyptian people have managed to prove that they were actually real people, a real societal movement that is asking for change. But they put this into doubt systematically. I think it's based in racism, consciously or unconsciously. But it's widespread. It's also probably linked to their own apathy and their own surrenderness about how to envisage the future of their state, that as they don't do much to change the situation and ask other people to do, and when the other people do, then suspect them of being employed by foreign intelligence or
good
something,
point, yeah.
Then actually they cannot believe that a people is capable of change. What I've seen, I was here during the Egyptian Revolution, is indescribable. It's amazing how the entire society, the entire generations were united with one very precise goal of having a state that respects their human dignity and that will fight for social justice. Then, of course, in the transitional period, the politicians and the political activists, or however you want to label them, got involved in the picture and are making things much more blur than what an ordinary citizen is fighting for. But this is the curse of having intellectuals.
I'm kind of chuckling, but I it's not a funny situation because I know exactly what you're talking about because I've seen this much of my life. It's interesting, those who make all these accusations about the U.S. hand in Egypt weren't paying no attention to Egypt before the uprising. They didn't know about the labor strikes. There was a movement already beginning.
Very strong.
Perhaps
yeah,
you
very
could,
strong.
Yes, perhaps you could talk about that before the uprising.
Well, I actually arrived in 2005 in Egypt, and it was probably more underground than nowadays. Between 2005 and 2006, there was the birth of what is called Kifaye, which means enough, which was a platform to ask for not voting for Mubarak in the so-called pluralist elections that Condoleezza Rice pushed for, you know, in this map for the new Middle East. So it was a cross-political movement just asking for people not to vote for Mubarak. And in parallel, there was the labor movement, but that really came to life in 2006 and was very strong until the revolution in different industries, especially the textile industry. In one town called Mahalla, they were heavily, heavily repressed, arrested, tortured, etc. And this movement grew to different parts of workers' constituency, I don't know how you say in English, to get some parts of society to complain about housing, about health, but you had to be really courageous to demonstrate, and you were confined to very small areas on stairs surrounded by riot police that were outnumbering you by 10 times. You know, it was very, very intimidating. But this for sure paved the way for what happened then in January. And the labor movement was very sympathetic to the revolution from very early, but not as labor movement. They were participating in their individual name, and they joined as free unions, self-proclaimed on ad hoc free independent unions towards the end, probably on the 7th or the 8th of February, which is 3 days before the collapse of the regime. Labor delegations went to Tahrir and called for a general strike and supported entirely the revolution. Since then, there has been a lot of reform, a lot of pressure from the labor movement to renationalize some companies that were privatized through corruption and through embezzlement and through nepotism, etc. And the movement is kicking and alive in every single industrial complex.
Now, this is a story that is largely not known so much in the West. Most of the credit for the uprising has been attributed to technology, or a lot of it to the social networking through Facebook, Twitter, and so on. You were there, so what is your position? How do you see that role, and how important was it of the social networking?
Well, yeah, you know, they cut us from any communication for a few days. It didn't prevent the numbers to swell in Tahrir Square. But I have to say that because there was no avenue for expression and dissident expression prior to the revolution, for sure it allowed for mobilization purposes very deeply to be a consequent number on the 25th. And the 25th was a total miracle to all of us. And I'm a political activist. Really, I remember on the 24th speculating that we might be 8,000 or 9,000. And local political activists were not putting numbers higher, and there was like this opposition newspaper spreading news about being probably up to 80,000, and we were laughing because it sounded totally impossible in the current situation. But then on the 25th, there were probably between 50 and 70,000 people on the square. This was organized not only via new technologies, it was organized with very courageous local activists going to popular areas, you know, distributing leaflets at their own life risk or risking imprisonment and torture. But for sure, the new technologies helped in the fact that the state could not control the pace and the there was no censorship on what was said on the internet. So I don't deny how it helped, but I think that it's a real society that revolted, that many of them cannot read and write, and so whether they had Facebook or not would not have changed the outcome.
Well, it certainly is something that is going to continue to develop. What's interesting is watching the foreign policy of Egypt, particularly vis-a-vis Israel, when a number of those who have no fondness for Israel were quite enthusiastic about the assault on the Israeli embassy in Cairo, and the response as a response to the killing of Egyptian soldiers by Israelis on the border in Sinai. How do you see that relationship developing?
Well, I think that the assault is a wrong move. I think the assault justified the imposition of the emergency law, and is actually like a kind of gift to the conservatives in the country. However, I see every demonstration in front of anything that is linked with Israel very, very important. But well, the country, just after the revolution, the foreign minister that was named was El Arabi, who is now heading the Arab League, and he had written during the revolution a very interesting piece on what is the interest of Egypt and its revolution regarding Israel. I think that it would be a mistake to enter in total confrontational mode with the Israeli state, as they did, you know, following the 52 revolution, because then all your economy is invested in a war effort and you actually cannot build the country. I think the most detrimental the biggest threat to Israel is a democratic, developed, strong, economically strong Egypt. Therefore, I salute any move that they do to represent Egypt as a strong power and representing the interests of the Arabs as a whole and the Palestinians in particular. But I think we should not get into the provocation of war that Israel is actually playing, you know?
They would love that, right. They need to have a belligerent state. They have to maintain that belligerency.
Exactly.
You know, actually, there are also those who are really out there who believe the whole Arab Spring was a Zionist plot, as if there were. it's quite extraordinary. I want to shift gears. I'm going to open the phone in a few minutes, but I want to shift gears to Iraq. After the U.S. Tried to strong arm the Iraqi government, such as it is, to give U.S. troops immunity, the Iraq government would not do that, and as a result, President Obama has announced the withdrawal of his troops, which is as I reported before I called you, has the neocons who brought us that war all jumping up and down, screaming as a betrayal and that we should have stayed in Iraq. What is your take on the current situation in Iraq? Because I know you've been an activist around the Iraq war from the beginning.
Well, I actually think that whether they leave like regular troops inside or not doesn't change the reality inside Iraq. There is thousands of contractors or mercenaries, private security, who are working for the Pentagon or State Department, and who are a shadow army. So the occupation doesn't end by the withdrawal of what is considered regular forces. One. Two, they are leaving Maliki back in power. They are in alliance with the Peshmerga, who have fought for the partition of Iraq.
It's the Kurdish Peshmerga, yes.
The Kurdish militia, who are more or less, they have agreed to grant the Americans a military base, but the rest of the country and Turkey, of course, and Iran for its own reasons oppose this. They have a kind of cake piecemealing deal with Iran on how to handle Iraq afterwards. So, I mean, whether they withdraw or not, they control the Iraqi economy. They even stipulated that they will continue to control the ports and the airspace. So it's not as if Iraq will be suddenly sovereign. And Iraq is destroyed. Iraq has 5 million displaced, some in neighboring countries, some inside the country. It's one-fifth of the population. Iraq has no infrastructure, has been bombed, and through via corruption and via all sorts of means, there is no electricity, there is no water. Iraq is like it's a fifth world country nowadays. So it's not as if we celebrate. There's nothing to celebrate.
And, of course, the United States maintains a embassy there, which is as large as Vatican City, which is like
which has 1,000 employees, 1,000 so-called civilian employees who each individually need 4 or 5 armed guards for their safety. I mean, and it's in the center of Baghdad. It's an occupied country. Whether the regular troops that make the Americans cry because they count their dead, you know, it's the only troops that you actually count in when you lose a soldier. The private contractors who are, some of them have American citizenship, others have all sorts of citizenship from across the planet. Nobody counts them, so we don't actually know what is the death toll that is going on in that conflict.
What do you see as Iran's role in terms of the Maliki government?
Iran is controlling the government. I mean, Iran, in association, in collaboration with the Americans, have been controlling Iraq since the very first day of the occupation and pushing for the partition of Iraq in 3 or more conflicting entities. Iran has flooded the market. Everything is imported from Iran nowadays. Iran is behind most of the militias who have been integrated in the new Iraqi police, in the new Iraqi army built by the Americans. So it's really a cooperation on the ground
between the United States and Iran, in this sense. The United States has given a gift to the Iranian government.
I think it's very old partnerships that we would have to study much closer. I think Iranian intelligence, for example, never cut their relation neither with the Americans nor with the Israelis. And you see this via different conferences that were planned ahead of the invasion, like the Soleimani conference, which was under the UN-administered part of Iraq, Kurdistan. had Kurdish separatist, Iranian sectarian forces, and the liberals, and they planned. It's there in 1994, I believe, that they adopted the system of quota for the rule of Iraq in the future, and then it got into a direct military operation. They wanted to impose it via other means, via the sanctions, Iraq was resisting so much that they had to actually go and occupy the country to try to do this, and they failed. Mm-hmm. But all this has been made with Iranian support.
My guess is Han Albayati. If you have a question for her, the number here, of course, 895-2448. This is we see. You mentioned Syria. Getting to Syria's role, Syria has been a much more important player geopolitically than Libya in terms of its location. And perhaps you could comment on this, the significance of what's happening in Libya.
In Syria.
In Syria, yes.
If Syria falls, and I think it has, whether it falls within a few weeks or within a year, it doesn't change. It changes the human toll, but it doesn't change the outcome about it. The Syrian government has lost all its legitimacy via its crackdown. But if Syria falls, then the card of Iran in the region crumbles, and it changes the entire reality, whether it's for Hezbollah, whether it's inside Iraq with pro-Iranian forces. So we are waiting with a lot of anxiety and with a lot of hope for this regime to fall. Syria has played a very anti-Arab role, but has managed to portray itself as an Arab-leading country. Syria participated the same way Egypt participated in the first Gulf War alongside the coalition. Syria criticizes Israel in words, but has not moved 1 meter to oppose Israeli policies in the region. They talk about Jolan every day, but they haven't actually confronted Israel ever. Syria, it's very problematic that the political analysts believe speeches.
I know.
Go on, yes. To us, it's, I think to anybody who supports the geopolitical reality of Arab unity, I'm not talking about something ethnic, or I'm talking about like a regional geopolitical interest to have unified policies and like benefiting each other, whether we are oil producing countries or not, how to actually build a strong economic power together as a region. If anyone is in support of this idea, all we are watching now is Syria.
Well, it's interesting. Most people aren't aware of the history of Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father. He refused to support the Palestinians during Black September 1970, where I happened to be in the Middle East at the time. And then he overthrew a very pro-Palestinian government of a Tasi and threw Palestinian supporters in Syria into prison, shut down their militia group al-Saika. In 76, he participated with the Christians in the massacre of Tal al-Zaatar in Beirut. And then in 83, when I was there after Israeli invasion of Lebanon, he had his own Palestinian troops attacking Palestinian refugee camps in northern Lebanon, which I saw for myself. So the notion that Hafez al-Assad is an enemy of Israel, supporter of the Palestinians, which many people believe, is a myth. Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. But I understand I have to mention that, for example, the Iraqi community in Syria, which is nearly 2 million refugees, are not outspoken against the regime currently, and we should not take this as their political position. I think they feel extremely threatened that they actually are stuck, they have nowhere to go to. So if they attack the regime will repress them and they cannot flee to Iraq or flee elsewhere. So a lot of anti-war, anti-occupation activists are taking the Iraqi stand on Syria as a proof that Syria is an anti-imperialist and leftist government, but actually the situation makes that for their own protection they cannot be outspoken. The response of the regime is so brutal.
So you say there, how many Iraqis are in Syria at the moment?
Nearly 2 million.
Yeah, and so obviously they would be in jeopardy. I mean, they're already refugees in the real sense, and if they spoke out, they wouldn't have it. They would be they'd be further repressed. They don't need that.
Exactly.
So this, of course, in speaking of Iraq, the refugees both in Syria and Jordan are ignored by the United States, and all the discussions we see about the Iraq war only talk about the U.S. role and not the destruction of the country. So you are permanently based in Cairo?
Yeah.
Because I didn't know that, I'm really glad to have reached you, because I'll be getting back to you to get information and updates on what is happening in Egypt. And Hana Albayati, I'm really happy to have had the opportunity to speak with you today, and I look forward to doing it again. Thanks so much for your insights.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Masalam.
Masalam. Bye.